So welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today I have Will McInnes.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello.
So Will, welcome. Tell me a bit about you and the work that you do.
Okay. I am a man.
I live
here in Brighton in the UK. I co-founded a business called Nixon McInnes, and we are a social business consultancy, which we can obviously talk more about.
Mm-hmm.
I recently wrote a book called Culture Shock, which comes out in August, and we're putting on this big event called Meaning. And the joining...
That's in October, right?
That's in October.
We'll link it all up.
Okay, thank you. But for me, the kind of glue that joins all of these things is just a really strong feeling that the world of business can be better, and in fact has to be better.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm kind of doing whatever I can to be part of that movement.
Fantastic. And has Nixon McInnes always been a social business consultancy?
Yeah, no, we haven't, is the answer. We were a tiny little web design and build company.
Mm-hmm.
But the two founding books behind our business, the concepts and the ideas, are encapsulated in Maverick by Ricardo Semler.
Which I love. We've talked about that before.
Yeah, which is an incredible book about one man's journey to turning his business into a democratic business, which totally inspired me and Tom, my co-founder. And the second book was The Clue Train Manifesto,
right,
which is all about how networks and markets are conversations, and really spoke about the potential of the world once it's all connected up.
Mm-hmm.
And those two books are still the fuel that drives this company and me. And so that's what we're all about. So along the way, we were a web designing company. Then we became a specialist social media agency, because that was the next big opportunity for organizations to become better connected and better at listening and dialogue and engaging with people instead of just ramming stuff down their throats.
Mm-hmm.
But for us, this next step, this social business journey, is not only the natural next step, but it's the biggest, most exciting step, because it's about the core of organizations and how they behave and what they stand for, not just how they communicate, which I think corporates are good at, you know, faking a certain style.
Mm-hmm.
But this goes to the heart. So yeah,
it's not what you say you do, it's what you actually do.
It is what
and
we
how
do.
You are.
It is what we do and what we are, and we're hoping to pilot and prototype those things, and are actually doing piloting and prototyping those things inside large organizations.
Excellent. So that brings me to the two main things I want to ask you about, and also why. And first of all, I want to ask you a bit about the social business stuff and what does it all mean. And also want to ask you a bit more about the democratic sort of workplace type of principles, particularly the World Blue movement, etc. And the reason why I want to do that is because on the blog, I'm really interested in how companies, businesses, organizations, movements, as it were, build better relationships with people, their customers, and also people, their internal customers, the people that they work with. Because I believe that actually relationships make the world go round.
Absolutely.
So first of all, let's start with the social business. So tell me, in your view, what is all this social business Kool-Aid? I mean, because I've seen all this sort of stuff, I mean, vendors and this, that, and it's all this, there's a big brouhaha about it, and I'm just thinking, what's it all about? What is it really?
So for me, I really like the word Kool-Aid, because I think there is a load of kind of bullshitty, vaporous, buzzwordy conversations about social business. And like you say, it's from vendors, by which we mean, you know, software, technology companies. And there's a really important role in all of this for technology, because technology enables, that's what the Clue Train Manifesto is about, is, well, what happens if I connect up all the people who work in the Dubai office with all the people who work in the Wilmslow office, but in a way that is more natural and more human and more connected, what happens? And that is enabled by technology, but it's not about technology.
Sure.
And so for me, social business, the promise of social business is so much more than technology. It's about organizations that are humanized. You know, I think if you look at the last 50 years of business, which I've only been a small part of personally, it's industrialized. You know, it was the great steps we made forward were about scale.
It's about Taylorism, isn't it? It's about that sort of division of labor.
Exactly.
It's about the kind of, you know, Adam Smith's principle back in the, you know, back in the Wealth of Nations, is about the pin factory.
Yeah. And I know I had a really interesting perspective from a lovely Scottish woman I know recently, Dr. Anne Marie McEwen, who was saying, you talk about social business, but have you ever been on a shop floor of a factory? And she'd say, you know, in the west coast of Scotland, those shipyards were social businesses, and you would be talking all day and your community was there. But somewhere along the way, we've lost that. We've lost sight of purpose. We've lost sight of meaning. You know, most people are dissatisfied with their work. Here in the West, we pursue GDP, so we pursue economic growth, but well-being is kind of being left behind. Happiness is low on the agenda. Most CEOs have a kind of command and control style. They're mainly men, they're mainly white. You know, there is gender inequality across most organizations. So there are all sorts of problems. People are suffering from too much email. More of us have portfolio careers. More of us work remotely or from home some of the time. The rise of Brazil, Russia, India, China. You know, take a trend, lump it in the bucket.
Yeah.
And for me, that swirling, blended mix of trends and drivers mean that we need a new kind of organization in the 21st century. One that listens, one that hears, one that can engage in dialogue, one that really values people internally and externally, and doesn't just tread roughshod over them.
So is it as simple as, you know, I saw to some people the other day and we were talking about social media and I said, well, what is it?
Yeah.
And they were going, is this, that, and that? And I'm like, well, I don't think it's actually about technology. Yeah. If you take two words, there's media, which is a channel,
yeah,
and there's a social, which is a description of the channel. And social, yeah, means it's two-way.
Yeah.
So it's not broadcast media, which is one way, like TV and radio and things, but social media is a two-way channel. So is that the same thing with business? You have business and it's there about solving the needs and the wants and the desires of customers in the most efficient, effective, and also profitable way, but to do it in a social two-way process that is imbued and sort of it has dialogue and conversation embedded in it.
Absolutely.
It's not as if you make stuff and you chuck it over the wall and then people either like it or don't like it. It's like actually you talk about it and you engage with it.
And I think the word that stood out for me when you were talking about business was about profitability. And I think profitability, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a business person, I understand profit and I value it, but unfortunately that became the overriding kind of outcome. And you know, if you read some of Umair Haque's work, we're talking about a world he's a good guy, but where the economic measures, the costs are hidden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the costs of obesity is not borne by the businesses that perhaps contribute towards it.
Sure.
The costs of poor well-being are not borne in the main by the businesses or organisations that have contributed to stress.
Sure.
And so there's been a relentless pursuit of profit, but the costs aren't shared. And what I'm talking about with social business and my version of a social business is about a business or an organisation that seeks to balance the costs and impacts and benefits and upsides in a more balanced and holistic way, rather than relentless pursuit of one thing and one thing only.
So it's not just about money?
It's not just about money, and it's not just about conversations. It's about a connectedness, a consciousness.
It's also about doing the right thing as well.
It's about doing the right thing. You know, I really think we're having an ethical crisis at the moment. I cannot abide some of the behaviour that I see. And I think, you know, where did ethics go in the boardroom and the business schools? And what did we leave at the door when we came to work? Because we need to change that.
You mentioned that, and I think it's fascinating because there's two things. One is I always find it very fascinating that the people that deal with a business customers, there are people that are in the call center and things, are generally the lowest paid people in the organization. And they're your brand advocates. I'm like, fascinating.
Yep, it's massive.
Kind of ironic.
Yep.
And then the second thing, you're talking about ethics and a crisis of ethics and a conversation about that. And it's quite interesting is that there's stuff coming out from politicians and talking, you know, whether it's Ed Miliband talking about stewardship and did a big speech the other day at the cooperative bank. And you've got Nick Clegg talking about employee ownership schemes and lauding the cooperative and the John Lewis models and all of those different types of things. Are we having that sort of crisis of capitalism, do you think?
I hope so. I think we need a good crisis, like we need a good forest fire.
Yeah.
And I and others are up for different models or systems if they're available. But in lieu of something else workable, I would like to see an enlightened capitalism. A capitalism with heart, with soul, with an understanding of the environment, sustainable business. And I'm not talking about just green and packaging and recycling, but
so it's not like that triple bottom line.
Not just that,
be part of the mix.
Yeah, too. Definitely could be, and employee ownership could be part of the mix, and so could lots of other things. But fundamentally, as a relatively young person in the world, I'm thinking, okay, what do we need to get done in the next 50 years? What are the problems we need to solve for my children growing up? What is the world going to be like? And when I look at charities, government departments, all of the different vehicles able to solve problems, in a weird way, the one I have the most confidence in is business.
Mm.
Because, and that might be naive, but it's because I've been there and I've seen it, and I've seen the agility and the focus and the, you know, just the getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to get things done in a better way. And for me, that's what social business is.
I just remember what I was going to say. You know what's fascinating? If we talk about business education, we would normally talk about the biggest business schools. You talk about the Harvards and the Londons, the MITs, the NSIs, all those sort of type of stuff. And what's quite fascinating is if you look at all their, say, MBA programs, they don't teach customer service.
Mm.
And they don't teach retention. And they don't teach loyalty and things. And I'm just thinking, and that's not the root of the problem.
No.
But it's an element.
Yeah.
Because if we're still teaching sort of production line, push it out, make it fast, cheap, push it out, sell it for as high a price as you possibly can, and it's not that sustainable sort of model, then and those are the breeding grounds of our future sort of CEOs or CEOs that are now, you're thinking,
I couldn't agree more. It makes me think of a couple of things. I'm reading the Game of Thrones books at the moment.
Okay.
And there's a character called Ned Stark, who's this king of the North. And, you know, he says to his kids, if you have to have a man executed, you need to swing the axe yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you talk about that MBA thing and that CEO thing, I'm thinking these guys aren't swinging their own axe. They're in the pocket, in the boardroom, tucked away from the action and not doing the dirty work themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think about, we've got a large client who's a rail operator. And the other day I ended up at Victoria Station, and it wasn't our client, but one of their peers, and it was Meet the Manager Day.
Right.
And there was literally a phalanx of besuited train managers, I guess middle and senior managers, stood right next to one another, so almost holding up clipboards like shields. They looked like a Roman centurion unit. Yeah. And if that, I mean, hats off to them for trying to meet customers, but you know, really, we need to go further than this. If CEOs and senior managers really got closer or use some of these social channels to really understand what's going on at the front line more, I think the world would be a better place.
See, I think there's an element in there, which is I've been looking at how different companies deal with sort of some of these sort of social feedback from different channels. And because most of the social stuff is handled by marketing, marketing generally don't answer the phone. They're sort of artists.
Mm-hmm.
They push things out. Oh, it looks beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then the phone rings and somebody wants a question about it. They don't really respond. So, and they don't talk to customer service because they're not quite as cool and sexy as they are. Not the in crowd, as it were. And so the things don't get done. So there's stats where it says something alarming, like 70% plus of all complaints, requests, queries that are pushed back into social channels to big brands are not getting answered.
Mm.
And so I'm thinking, well, obviously you've got there's two siloed and I need to connect those up. But I actually think we need to go further than that. And I'm a big advocate of the idea that, you know what, in order to build empathy and to build understanding and connectedness and really sort of understand at a granular level and in the company's DNA what it is to be a customer, that everybody should have it timetabled into their diary to spend at least an hour a week on the help desk or on the phones answering these kind of queries from the CEO all the way down to the shop floor.
Yeah.
And if we did that, we'd revolutionise everything. Everything.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, we haven't got the technology. That's rubbish. We do have the technology to do that.
Mm.
And I wish more companies, I know there's some companies that do that, but I wish more people would do that. And because you would reduce that ivory tower to rubble.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, you wouldn't have these managers that would kind of be kind of up with the clipboards and stuff and be afraid of their customers. That customer could be your neighbour.
Yeah.
Why are you scared of them?
Yeah.
And I think that, for me, I'm sorry, I'm off my soapbox a little bit, but that's, for me, is an idea that I wish some companies would sort of take that on, because we can do that. You talk about technology, we can enable ourselves to do that.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I enjoyed the soapbox. I mean, I'm with you 100%, and I don't think it's even that mysterious. You know, like, the brands that are doing well with this stuff do that kind of thing. You know, at Zappos, everyone does 2 weeks on the customer service training and does work on the phones, and regardless if you're the new COO or whatever. Yeah. it's a no-brainer.
No, it is fascinating, but it's all, I guess it's all about, you talk, coming back to a point you made before, it's about making business kind of more human, but it's about also injecting a degree of respect and deflating the ego bit and inflating more respect into it in terms of for our general human beings. It's not about being feudal.
No.
It's not about command and control. It's actually, it's about respect. It's about, I hate it now, it's a trite word, but it's about engaging with people as normal people. Just talking and listening.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think for us, with our own experience we do here at Nix & McInnes, what we learn is that we need to wean ourselves off these things, all of us, even those of us that think we're somehow enlightened or whatever. Like, we've got great guys out there who want to progress.
Mm.
And normally they would progress through a hierarchy.
Yeah.
And that would give them the milestones. It would give them the satisfaction, the progress. It would give them a currency that they can talk to their parents about or their friends or their boyfriend or girlfriend. So I think what I'm trying to say also is, change is really hard, and personally I know that I almost want both.
Mm-hmm.
I want the old stuff. I want the rewards and the titles and the office, and I want to be better and nicer and more human. Do you see what I mean?
And you want to be free, but you want the structure to be free within, in a way.
It's really hard, really hard. So I think we do need to recalibrate, you know, whether it's reset, recalibrate, whatever.
Well, I think we need to realise that actually the way that we do things, it's learned behavior, it's habits, and in order to break a habit you've got to, it takes will, it takes commitment, it takes a process, it takes plans and preparation and practice and endurance and all of that sort of stuff. And sometimes you'll be successful and sometimes you won't, but it's about commitment to the whole, you know, the process and the journey, and realizing that actually that's a really well paved, you know, metalled tarmac hardened kind of road, and that one's a bit of a forest track with lots of ruts and stuff. And if you're running along that in a family saloon, it's probably not necessarily the best vehicle for it. So it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Yeah.
And fair play to you for, you know, for taking it on. I mean, because that brings me on to the my sort of next point, is that you've progressed around this along this journey around creating a more democratic sort of company.
Yeah.
And it's, which is all, was that guided by the World Blue organization, or is that something that you did and then you joined the World Blue, or what came first, chicken or egg?
The chicken. So we started, Maverick came first, the book, we started doing stuff, and then we found World Blue. In that way that you do when you start doing things, you get those moments of serendipity, those unintended consequences where you gravitate towards things. And you know, one of us found World Blue, and what we found really useful about World Blue is their scorecard, which we use annually, which is a kind of surveying tool that everyone here does anonymously, and that gives us the benchmark about how and where we're progressing.
Yeah.
And they're also really good at giving us a sense of being part of a wider community. Until that point, we did feel pretty alone, and that's one of the challenges about doing business differently that I've found is, the role models and the kind of 101 textbooks aren't really there because it is the path less trodden, and that's something we want to change.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been great and they're really lovely, and I recommend anyone who's interested in this area to contact them.
And there's some big companies that are in their sort of membership.
That's right.
I mean, Zappos is there, HCL is there, and they're probably the two biggest poster boy.
Yeah, I think the other third one is DaVita, which we don't really know over here, but it's a massive sort of medical healthcare company in the States.
I think W.L. Gore might be in there as well.
Yeah, is Gore in there? It might be, but Gore do really cool things, so they should be if they're not. So yeah, it's a really credible and growing list, and I think what I like about World Blue is their ambition. So, you know, Tracy at World Blue often says, we want, you know, our mission is to see 1 billion people working in democratically run enterprises, and that sounds like a cool goal.
Yeah, that sounds brilliant. So there's those two things. There's a social business and then there's democratically run organisations.
Yeah.
How important is it for you that what impact do those two things have in helping you, one, engage, deliver more value to your customers and keep customers and all this, and also that you do the same for your people?
Yeah.
Those things, are they fundamental to what you do, or are they incidental to what you do?
I think they're fundamental, but I don't think the connection is explicit all of the time. So right. I think that the way the people here behave is then naturally carried through into the work that they do, the style of the approach they work with clients. So you know, we try and have mature, open conversations. Mm-hmm. We try and be honest with one another. We try and be authentic. We try and work in agile ways. All of those things that kind of come with democratic working.
Because mm-hmm.
if there's no command and control and there's no boss that you can go to say, you know, Adrian's really letting me down at the moment. I want you to tell him to buck his ideas up. But that's kind of sounds great. But the challenge is then I have to speak to you and I have to say, Adrian, yesterday when you said that to me, I felt really bad. And that's so damn hard. And there's not one day that goes here at Nick's McInnes without someone, any of us, me included, trying to avoid a difficult conversation with someone that has to happen.
Right. So it's a bit like rules of the playground in a way.
Yeah.
You have to almost learn to fight your own battles and be grown up about it.
Yeah, and we have to try and support that. So that naturally gets carried through to client work. If we're running a workshop or a project for a client and there are issues, you know, we don't want to be treated in that kind of like supplier, client supplier way. We want to be partners. And so helping those guys learn to speak that same way it can be really helpful to them.
Mm.
Helping them prepare for difficult conversations with their colleagues. So a lot of the work that we do involves getting our clients better connected in their own organisations, getting HR, talking to marketing, talking to legal, talking to compliance, and helping them kind of make those calls, make those connections, helping them to create those relationships and build that trust.
So you're getting more and more into the employee engagement field, because that seems to be a bit of a subset of the whole social business.
Yeah,
as well.
I think that bit is one of the growing areas, yeah, because that's what needs to happen. So we're working with a book publisher at the moment and the brief was pretty much, our world has changed, how people engage with our product, i.e. books, has changed because of Kindle and iPhones and everything else. We don't know much about our customers because we're muscled out by either Tesco or Amazon, who we sell through, and they have loads of data and intelligence on the customers. We don't know anything about them. How we commission books, how we curate books hasn't changed in 50 years. So the brief there is help us become more digital.
Right.
And they would see that as about digital innovation.
Mm-hmm.
We would say that belongs in a broader canvas of this move towards social business.
Mm-hmm.
But we wouldn't go to them on day one and say, guys, you need to become a democratic organisation.
No.
We would help them with practical kind of the steps they need to make.
Yeah.
But it's all, for us, it's all part of the same thing.
Well, it's a bit like, you know, so it's sort of a small child going to their mother or father and saying, I want to learn a bike, and the mother or father goes out and buys them the yellow jersey of Brad Wiggins for the Tour de France and goes like, there you go, son, daughter, you will win the Tour
you're
de
ready.
France.
You're
ready. It's like going, no, you get a small bike with some stabilisers.
Exactly.
And you actually get a trike to start with, and you start off with it because you've got to learn the actions, as it were.
Exactly.
You want to feel like what it's like to sit on a seat and put your feet on pedals and all of those different sort of things.
Exactly.
Because engagement is a big word. When I think it gets bandied around a lot, and I've had been asked to go and speak to people around engagement, and it was a joint meeting between HR and marketing.
Mm.
They were said, like, we say engagement, employee in the front of it, then it becomes HR, and put customer in the front of it, becomes marketing, and then there's a bit of a bun fight if it's ill-defined. So they said, come and talk to us about the link between the two, why we should work together, how we should work together, all of that sort of stuff. And so basically referee a wrestling match, which is quite fascinating.
Yeah.
And is that what the new book that's coming out, and which we'll revisit sort of when it kind of comes live, is that what the culture shock is actually starting to talk about, or is it talking about that and broader sort of stuff?
That and broader stuff. For me, the goal in writing, you know, people said to me is, don't write a book if you want to make money. Writing a book was an attempt to spread the word.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that in the wake of Maverick, there isn't another book that builds on those kind of practices and says, wake up world, this is a tidal wave.
Yeah.
And don't feel alone, you're not the only ones. And so I wanted to literally join up some of those practices, behaviours and approaches that lots of different businesses are taking and get them down in a book. So Culture Shock is, you know, there's some stuff about Zappos in there, there's some stuff about W.L. Gore, who make Gore-Tex, amazing company, some stuff about Grameen in Bangladesh.
I love Grameen.
Amazing. So all of these organisations that you and I would think are cool, in the book I've kind of tried to distill the essence of them and to accelerate this tidal wave. That's my goal.
There's also a difficulty in this, is because the people that are talking about social enterprises and have built social enterprises, like Professor Yunus that runs Grameen, set up the Grameen Bank, they've been around for years, in fact decades. And I think these probably feel slightly hijacked by this social business thing coming up. And they're like going, what?
Yeah.
We've been doing this for ages.
Yeah.
This is just the way that we do things.
Yeah.
And probably rightfully so.
Yeah, it's a real shame because I think, you know, I read his second book, which is about putting forward the idea of a social business, and I believe in that. The challenge we have as a business ourselves is to pick the wording that not only works for us best, but also that has momentum.
Yeah, sure.
And it is really annoying because social business, if you Google for it, you're going to get a load of technology software. And somewhere down the list, you'll have Professor Eunice's definition. And then for me, there's almost like a bridge that spans the two, and that's what I want it to be about.
But it is also about translating kind of that, because I know that Green Bank is, it's a darling of the World Bank, it's a darling of the multilaterals, it's a darling in that sort of the poverty and microfinance and microenterprise sort of field and all of that, which is brilliant. But just because it happens over there, people find it really hard to translate practice from here to over here, so you almost need somebody to write something else or do something else which goes, actually, this is what it means over here. It's not different.
Yeah.
Just use the same sort of language.
Yeah.
And to translate and help people make sense of it.
Yeah. I think there's a whole nother conversation on language, and I think you've touched on it a few times, but you know, what do we mean by engagement? What do we mean by social business? And I think we could do better with some of our language, but also, for me, I just want to get on with it, you know. I want to get into it and just go, I don't care if some US tech vendors are talking about this too much, and sorry, Mr. Eunice, but I'm going to run at this thing.
Well, I think that's absolutely fair, and I mean, I applaud that, because I think that sometimes there's too much talk and not enough doing. I mean, I wrote something on another blog the other day, and I said, look, I thought it's fascinating. I thought, go back to the Ed Miliband sort of speech and then the Nick Clegg speech, and they were talking about we need more competition, we need more sort of employee ownership, sort of somebody to lead the way. And I'm thinking, hang on, don't we own one of these banks? Why don't we take one of those banks? Why don't we just turn it on its head and turn it into an employee-owned, mutual, cooperative sort of thing? Because we've got that.
Now you are talking my language.
And then we go like, well, because they're talking to each other. You get a cross-party sort of thing, and you can radicalise the whole thing. Just do it. We've got the resources to do it.
It would be amazing. I personally think...
And if they did that, they'd just get re-elected with a landslide.
Massively. I think we're going to see much more employee ownership in the next 20 years, personally, I think. Because I think when you have a more empowered workforce and a more connected workforce, eventually the natural consequence is, well, why would I do that for you? Why don't I do it? You know, we five can leave and start it on our own. We'll own it. And I do think we're going to see a boom. And I think it will be good for all of us. If you look at John Lewis, you look at Waitrose, they ain't doing so badly.
No, they're great. I mean, they're great because actually the people are invested in what they're doing, which is tremendous. It's not about, you talk about purpose. It's not about just, you know, the job and getting paid. It's actually, I'm part of something.
Yeah.
You know, I believe in it. I
mean,
crikey, the Quakers had it nailed.
Yeah.
Had it totally nailed back in the day.
Totally.
And, oh man, we don't learn from history. We are destined to repeat it.
Yes.
So, fascinating. There's too many things.
That was a great quote. I saw that on Twitter earlier, actually. I follow philosophers' quotes, and that was today's.
Which one was that?
If we don't learn from history, we something.
We're destined to repeat it.
Yeah.
So, that's fascinating. Thank you for that. But the one thing I always like to do at the end of all of these kind of conversations, is I ask this one question. And I say, is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Oh, what a brilliant question. Well, I want to plug three things. Culture Shock, the book, because I wrote it and it's out in August. Available for pre-order now. We're putting on a conference. If you're interested in these topics, we're putting on a conference called Meaning on the 1st of October. It's going to be amazing. We've got speakers talking about happiness at work, environment and business, behaviour change, all sorts of other stuff. I think that's me plugged.
That was two.
Two. Well, the third one, I was going to plug Brighton, to be honest. If you don't know Brighton, it's a little seaside city, 45 minutes from London. It's where some of the greatest creative and digital businesses in the UK reside. And we're going to start a revolution, and we're going to have more and more businesses that are social businesses and that stand for something more than just profit. That is my third plug.
Brilliant. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Adrian.
Fantastic.